Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Professor Katka Reske, author of The Return of the Jew, Exploring Jewish Identity Among Second and Third Generation Young People in Eastern Europe. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. A couple of weeks ago, I traveled to a rabbinic conference back east, the Greater Carolina Association of Rabbis, which is one of the best rabbinic organizations I have ever experienced. Now, you might well wonder just what it was that qualified me to attend a conference of rabbis from the Carolinas, since I've been a rabbi in Arizona for the past 19 years. I have to tell you, the rules at the Greater Carolina Association of Rabbis are quite simple. If you currently are a rabbi in either North or South Carolina, or have previously been a rabbi in either state, or are or have been a rabbi in a nearby state like Virginia, Florida, Georgia, Maryland, or Delaware, or happen to have close friends who are rabbis in one or another of those states, or have visited one of those states, or have flown over one of those states, well, then you qualify. Since I actually was the city rabbi in Spartanburg, South Carolina long ago and attended the conference regularly during those years, I qualified to return to the Greater Carolina Association of Rabbis Conference with an emphasis on the word Greater Carolinas. In any case, this particular conference focused on the Talmud, the great Jewish storehouse of law and its derivations. We studied with a fine scholar rabbi named Amy Scheinerman, who has a book on Talmud coming out in October from the prestigious Jewish Publications Society, JPS. One of the most interesting aspects of Talmudic study for most of us non-Orthodox rabbis, and there were Reform, Conservative, and Reconstructionist rabbis joined at this conference, the most interesting part is the interplay in Talmud of law and lore, of halacha and agadah, that work together to help determine the right course of action in the extensive array of legal subjects the Talmud addresses. In other words, to know the right thing to do in any given situation according to Jewish tradition, you need to both know what laws the Torah itself has decreed about a subject, and also how the long history of rabbis has explored the practical meaning of those laws, how they are best applied in every given situation. And since this is a Jewish process of determining the right way to apply laws, there's a great deal of arguing back and forth over the generations. Want to know how many times to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah? You will find many opinions explored in depth in the Talmud, plus a number of stories about the shofar and some random tales about the rabbis who are discussing the question. There's something quite beautiful about the careful but also free way the great scholars of the ages explore the meaning, implications of, and balance between various legal, personal, communal, and even national needs in making decisions on everything from how to pray to how to cook to how to get married or divorced, to how to honor your parents, even how to properly repent from sin. And although the rabbis of the Talmud were extraordinarily learned scholars, they were also extraordinarily opinionated rabbis, sometimes even they could not resolve a difficult problem. Occasionally in the Talmud, in an act of quite beautiful and unusual humility, they will use a most interesting word, an abbreviation actually. That word is teku, which stands for four Hebrew words that mean essentially, when the Messiah comes, Elijah the prophet will solve the remaining problems and questions. It's a way of saying, no matter how smart we are and how much Torah we know, no matter how carefully we've constructed our arguments or arranged our proofs, we cannot solve these challenges. Only God can do it. Eventually, we hope and pray. Until then, we must admit our failure, accept our limitations. And then the rabbis move on to work on a different problem, and that one they almost always can solve. Wouldn't that be an amazing thing to hear from, oh, say, the President of the United States from time to time? I tried, but I can't solve this. It's nobody's fault. I'm just not smart enough. I give up trying to control this thing I can't control. I leave it in the realm of the Almighty. Teku, this problem is beyond us right now. We tried very, very hard to solve it, but let's leave it in God's hands for the present. When the Messiah shows up, then we'll get our answer. I wonder if this teku idea also has a place in our own daily lives, because we sometimes encounter problems or layers of complexity that are genuinely beyond our abilities to solve them, no matter how hard we try. We should, of course, try to fix everything we reasonably can, perform our own version of tikkun olam, but we also need to know when something is beyond us, to let it go, move on to solving things we can solve. It's a beautiful message indeed in this month of Elul, this season of return and repentance. Let the impossible go, teku, and work on what you can fix in your own life. To play a sin this morning, here's part of our preview of High Holy Day music for this year, Areshet Sfatenu. May the words of our lips be pleasing to you, God, who hears the shofar.
Areshes efoseinu yerav lefonecho el erom beniso.
Areshes efoseinu yerav lefonecho el erom beniso.
Mevino mabit mazino makshiv lekol lekol tekioseinu.
Mevino mabit mazino
Uskapele berachamim berachmim uverotzon Seider eseider malchu yoseinu
Uskapele berachamim berachmim uverotzon Seider eseider malchu yoseinu.
That was Areshet Sfatenu, sung by cantor Alberto Mizrahi for the coming High Holy Days, now just 3 weeks away. Our guest this morning, Professor Katka Reschke, author of The Return of the Jew, explores the development of Jewish identity among young people in Poland after the Holocaust and after the end of the long communist domination of Eastern Europe. She is a brilliant and fascinating guest. Meet her when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Katka Reschke has a PhD, is a writer, filmmaker, photographer who works in the U.S. and in Poland. She's the author of Return of the Jew, Identity Narratives of the Third Post-Holocaust Generation of Jews in Poland, is a visiting scholar at the Mandel Center for Studies in Jewish Education, a research associate at Hadassah Brandeis Institute, and really an expert on the reviving experience of people coming back to their Jewish identity in the post-Cold War world. I don't know if that's the right way to put it. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about how you began on this course of study and on your career.
Well, there are two stories here. One is my personal story of arriving at Jewish identity in my life, and that actually sort of happened in parallel with my interest in other people's Jewish identities. My personal story is a very long one, beginning with literally a hunch that I was Jewish at around the age of 15.
Wow.
But then, you know, a few years later, after I'd read everything that I could about Judaism, about being Jewish, about Jewish history, I started interviewing young Jews in Poland, and I started writing about their identity processes, which I found, you know, fascinating while sort of still on my own journey of self-discovery.
I remember reading a book long ago called Hole in the Heart of the World, which was kind of a journalistic exploration of Jews coming to Jewish identity right after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe. You've done more than approach this journalistically. You know, it's really a sociological exploration of what the experience is and studied it carefully. You know, for those of us who grow up in milieus in which being Jewish was normative or people were running away from Judaism, it's so fascinating to watch people running towards Judaism or taking baby steps toward Judaism anyway. Can you talk a little bit about how that experience works?
Right. I often laugh. I've lived in the States for almost 11 years now, and since I work in Jewish education, I keep hearing about this anxiety that there is in America about how do we make our kids want to be Jewish. And, you know, my joke is always for me, don't send them to Israel, send them to Poland. Right. I don't know, for some reason, it works over there.
You know, it's not such a joke. I've seen it myself in Krakow.
Well, exactly. And this is, you know, this brings me back to how we met. We met in the most extraordinary of ways. We went on a bike ride.
On bicycles.
On bicycles. It's a miracle that we recognize each other the following day.
It is.
With our helmets and our sunglasses and our sweaty faces. But yes, well, you know, the history of obscuring Jewish roots in Poland goes back more than two generations. The fall of communism only prepared this newer ground for people to be able to explore in different ways and to be able to explore more freely, to actually ask the questions that they may have faced earlier. But there was no language to speak about Jews, really, for many years in Poland. It was a very kind of awkward world, socially and culturally, Jews in Poland. And then after communism, there were two things that happened. Suddenly, there were Poles who became interested in Jewish culture. They became interested in wait, how come my town was 90% Jewish before the war, and I'm only now learning about this, and I learned nothing about this in school. And so you suddenly had, and still today, you have Polish people who are discovering the history that their history was surrounded by, but so completely obscured. And a lot of people, as you yourself know, become actively involved in trying to create Jewish cultures, trying to create spaces for Jewish culture, trying to create spaces to uncover Jewish history, to bring about more education about different towns, Jewish pasts. And this happens in small towns in Poland. It happens in cities in Poland. There are more Jewish festivals happening in Poland, I think, than anywhere in the world right now. And the largest Jewish culture festival in the world happens in Krakow every
right,
year.
Right where we were this year. So,
which is where we met, yes.
We'll come back to this question with Katka Reschke when we return on To Jewish in just a moment. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or a kvel, please email us at tojewishradio18@gmail.com, tojewishradio18@gmail.com, or visit our website at tojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Aden, director of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
I'm smiling a little bit because you just came back from Israel, and mm-hmm. that's always a great experience, of course, going back
right.
there. This time your son did some very special work. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yes. So first I'll start by saying that I believe that our children learn from what we do and not just what we say. You know, so if I say to our kids, look, it's very important to volunteer, and we never do. That's, you know, that's what they learn. So in our family, it's very important to us to volunteer, and we volunteered in any state that we've been. And when we go back to Israel and on vacation, we always make sure that we volunteer as a family. So in this case, we're old enough to do it by themselves. So my younger one, who just had a bar mitzvah, volunteered for one evening in Kiryat Malachi, which is our partnership in Israel. And he came with us, obviously, you know, just to get to know the people.
Now,
and,
by the way, I should know, Kiryat Malachi in the south is not a, you know, super rich area.
No, it's actually not. It's low income, economically difficult, struggling, and it's true. So we came to a place where there were 120 high school kids. He's going into ninth grade next year. And met some friends there, and they went out and basically provided food to families who don't have food. So that was a wonderful thing that he did. And, you know, we arrived at about 8 p.m. and left seriously at 1 a.m.
Mm.
And he loved it and asked to go back. The older son, who's 17 and a half, Gal, volunteered for a full week. So not an hour or a day. Seven overnight and a full week from Sunday to Sunday at a village for youth at risk and in the south next to an Air Force.
Now, youth base. At risk means kids who've gone through some terrible experiences, family experiences, rape, assault,
sexual assaults and being thrown from the homes and being rescued by a wonderful woman called Maryuma Ben Yosef, who actually is a recipient of an Israel Award for volunteering, and she saved from the streets thousands or tens of thousands of children in Israel. And she has two homes, not institutions, homes, one a village in the south and the other one in Tel Aviv, where kids wake up in the morning and they must want to be there. They're not forced to stay. And they work with them, and they have responsibilities. They clean after themselves. They share a room. They have duties. And my son came there. I met those children, obviously appreciated more what he has you know, in his daily lives, and did everything that all the chores that I needed. Now they have their animals, so children can take care of the animals, horses and extra. And so they can share responsibilities, learn responsibility, and take care of you know, an animal,
right?
And through that, have self-confidence and believe in themselves. And I've known this institution for about 7 years, and it's amazing. It's just amazing to see the successful stories of children who went to the army and universities.
So when people want to go over or going over for vacation, they maybe should plan not just a vacation but a chance to do some volunteering.
I strongly suggest that they will.
And they
everyone
can
that goes to Israel can contact me.
Contact the Israel Center, the Weintraub Israel Center.
I'll be more than happy to either coordinate a visit or coordinate a volunteering experience to the family or individual.
Thanks so much, Amir.
Of course.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, not too long ago, you returned from a tiny country, but a very beautiful one, Montenegro, which has become, oddly, a point of controversy.
Right. Montenegro has been in the news, actually, a lot during the Trump presidency. First of all, because at a NATO summit, there's a horrible video of Trump pushing
the president of Montenegro,
the prime minister of Montenegro, out of the way so that he could be in the front row for a group photo. And he's just like, you know, a rude bully for no reason at all. And then much more recently, after his one-on-one with Putin in Helsinki, he went on air to say that one of the many reasons he's opposed to NATO is Article 5, which obliges the U.S. and every other signatory of the North Atlantic Treaty to treat an attack on any member country as an attack on itself and to respond in kind. So he said, does that mean that if the Montenegrins, who are aggressive and belligerent and nasty people, begin World War III, that we have to go to their rescue? That's ridiculous. Now, there's widespread speculation that here he's not pursuing anything like an American agenda, but an agenda of the Russian Federation, which has long had eyes on Montenegro as a warm water port. I mean, a very long-term objective of Russian foreign policy since, you know, 1,000 years probably, has been to acquire a warm water port.
From the time of the Counts of Kiev.
Right. So Montenegro has one key port on the Adriatic. It is warm weather. It's not directly linked by land. In fact, there's a lot of mountainous terrain between Montenegro and the Russian Federation. And one of the ways to cross that terrain is through a new road that's being financed by the Chinese in their worldwide rivalry with Russia. So, I mean, it's a very complicated thing where two great powers are playing out a rivalry in unlikely corners of the earth, like Montenegro, which is, first of all, a tiny country. There's 600,000 people altogether. Second of all, Montenegro per capita has more troops fighting alongside American troops in Afghanistan than we do, never mind any other country, because it's so small. Its standing army is like 2,200 people. And of that, you know, over 10% is deployed in Afghanistan.
In Afghanistan, fighting alongside Americans.
So, and by the way, the only time since the North Atlantic Treaty was signed at the end of the 40s that Article 5 has been invoked was by the U.S. in the wake of 9/11. We invoked that as an attack by foreign enemies. But back to why was I in Montenegro? Montenegro has never had and still doesn't have much of a Jewish community to speak of, but there's a family with whom I'm very close, and four generations of that family were gathered at their seaside home, where they have a couple boats and direct access to a beach and all that.
By the way, beautiful coast there. Yeah. Just gorgeous.
To celebrate the 94th birthday of the patriarch. So his children are friends of mine. One in particular of his grandsons is a friend of mine. And I went to that guy's wedding in Istanbul 5 years ago. And that guy has since had two sons who I met for the first time in Montenegro. And the real reason I went to Montenegro was the combination of Milan's 94th birthday and to meet the two little boys who represent the fourth generation in that family. And it was a lovely, warm time with delicious food and great boat rides around the Bay of Kotor and whatever. You've been there, so I don't have to tell you. For your listeners, it's one of the most spectacularly beautiful places in the world.
Beautiful,
just full of nature.
Yeah, gorgeous. And interesting hills and interesting ruins on the hillsides, and just a beautiful part of the world, and an interesting one, and yet somehow part of a political conflict right now. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rebecca goes to see her rabbi. He can see right away she's very angry. She immediately tells him that she wants a divorce from her husband. Why? The rabbi asks. What's the matter? Rebecca replies, I have a strong suspicion that he's not the father of our youngest child. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This Shabbat, we read the portion of Ki Tetzeh from the middle section of Deuteronomy, Devarim. Ki Tetzeh contains more laws than any other Torah portion, 74 in all. Among them, rules that apply to warfare, laws related to safe and proper building construction, and labor laws, more enlightened than those that exist in the United States today. But there is one area of Jewish law addressed in Ki Tetzeh that remains especially relevant. In this section of our portion, the Torah instructs us to take special care in the treatment of the dead, in their burial, and the dignity and attention we accord to those who have passed. These mitzvot form the core of the great rabbinic instruction, both to accompany the dead for burial, to comfort the bereaved with dedication and sincerity. This set of rules and laws have proven to have enduring meaning for Jews more than 2,500 years after their creation. While most of the laws in Ki Tetzeh are related to how we live, this section focuses on how we treat those who pass away. In a remarkable way, this text reminds us of our shared humanity and mortality. and the debt we owe to those who gave us life and taught us how to live and thrive in this world. The basis for such important sacred customs is Chevra Kedisha, the ritual washing of the dead, Leviat HaMeid, accompanying the departed through the burial, and Nichum Avelim, comforting the bereaved in a consistent and dedicated way, are rooted here in Ki Teitse. These customs have bound together synagogue communities, and thus our Jewish communities throughout history. We demonstrate core values of care and loyalty when we live these laws and customs. Every religion has its own strengths, and Judaism has long been considered especially sensitive and appropriate in its traditions and practices at times of loss. It is Ki Teitse that inspired these mitzvot, and it is the enduring way in which we remember our loved ones and the respect with which we treat those who are gone that defines the kind of people we are. In this way, we are taught to be menschen, to show human decency, care, and love. And that allows our remembrance to achieve true holiness and sanctity. In effect, a key way to know who we really are and what values we uphold lies in how we treat our dead and how we help our bereaved. Nothing testifies better to the quality of our community. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Professor Katka Reschke, will explain why affirming Jewish identity sometimes seems to be more popular in Poland than it is in America. Find out why when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Egypt and the UN brokered a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas that took effect last week. Among the provisions of the year-long ceasefire, Israel is committed to the reconstruction of Gaza and discussing the possibilities of airports and seaports in the Hamas-controlled coastal territory. It has agreed to permit a shipping route between Cyprus and the Gaza Strip and agreed to allow Qatar to fund fuel for the population of the impoverished area. The ceasefire's implementation began last week following months of escalating tension between Israel and Hamas. The deal includes six main clauses, including a comprehensive ceasefire, the reopening of Gaza's border crossings, an expansion of the permitted fishing zone, medical and humanitarian assistance, a resolution to the issue of captive Israeli soldiers, missing and dead civilians and prisoners, a broad reconstruction of Gaza's infrastructure with foreign funding, and discussions about sea and airports in Gaza. The Israeli cabinet approved the deal, with Ayelet Shaked and Naftali Bennett of the hardline Jewish Home Party the only ministers who dissented publicly. Israel reopened the Keren Shalom border crossing last week. According to Israel's coordinator of government activities in the territories, tons of goods, medical, and other humanitarian personnel have since entered the Gaza Strip. An Israeli spokesman said there will be no real arrangement with Hamas without the return of our sons and civilians and the promise of prolonged calm. Hamas continues to hold two Israelis and the bodies of two soldiers who were killed back in 2014. Israel will maintain security control over cargo traffic between Gaza and Cyprus, and Qatar will start paying for Gaza's electricity immediately. The Qataris, in conjunction with Egypt, will also begin to provide funding for the salaries of Gazan civil servants. Recent weeks have seen Hamas fire hundreds of rockets and send many, many other incendiary devices into Israeli territory, while the Israelis carried out numerous retaliatory strikes against the terror group's outposts and fighters. We hope that is now all in the past. The breakup between Jewish megadonor and activist Ron Lauder and Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu is now complete. Lauder launched Bibi into the prime minister's seat, but last week Netanyahu was the target of a scathing column by Ron Lauder, the cosmetics heir who heads the World Jewish Congress. The article lamented Israel's recent nation-state law, which Netanyahu defends as a safeguard of Israel's Jewish character, but critics see as a slap in the face of the country's minorities. Lauder wrote that Israel's turn to the nationalist right is betraying its and the Jewish people's commitment to democratic, humanistic ideals. Lauder wrote, "The Jews of the new era have fused our national pride and religious affiliation with a dedication to human progress, worldly culture, and morality. Conservatives and liberals, we all believe in a just Zionism and a pluralistic Judaism that respects every human being. So when members of Israel's current government unintentionally undermine the covenant between Judaism and enlightenment, they crush the core of contemporary Jewish existence." This is the second time Lauder has taken to the New York Times to lambaste Netanyahu's agenda. Back in March, he lamented the demise of the two-state solution under Netanyahu and the power of Orthodox parties in Israel, warning that by submitting to the pressures exerted by a minority in Israel, the Jewish state is alienating a large segment of the Jewish people. Without Lauder's support originally, Netanyahu likely never would have become prime minister. Back in 1996, the first time Bibi Netanyahu ran for prime minister, he was a major underdog facing a 30-point deficit to incumbent Shimon Peres. Yitzhak Rabin, Israel's prime minister, had been assassinated just months earlier by a Jewish terrorist opposed to the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, the Oslo process. Beyond the national sympathy for Rabin's Labor Party at the time, some saw Netanyahu as complicit in the incitement that led to the assassination. A month before the assassination, he had participated in an anti-Rabin rally where people waved photos of Rabin in an SS uniform and chanted that he was a traitor. It was Peres' election to lose. Then Ron Lauder, a Netanyahu ally since Bibi was Israel's ambassador to the UN in the 1980s, stepped in. Lauder was a major donor in Netanyahu's 1996 run, but more crucially, he brought Republican campaign strategist Arthur Finkelstein in to work on the campaign. Finkelstein came up with the slogan, "Peres will divide Jerusalem in peace negotiations," and it worked. A stark attack ad, complete with a black screen, red text, and ominous narration, warned that Peres had failed, while a Netanyahu victory would mean a secure peace. A string of suicide bombings in the weeks before the election damaged the public's faith in Peres. Netanyahu won a shocking upset, beating Peres by just 1%. During Netanyahu's 1999 re-election campaign, when Lauder chaired the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, he praised Netanyahu's economic policies in a speech, kind of endorsing Bibi's successful candidacy. So why the falling out now, after decades of strong support? In 2011, Israeli Channel 10 aired an unflattering investigation into Sarah Netanyahu, Bibi's wife, accusing her of an inappropriately extravagant lifestyle. Lauder has a stake in the channel, but refused to pressure Channel 10 to drop the segment. And in the meantime, Bibi got a new benefactor, Sheldon Adelson. In 2007, the casino mogul and Republican megadonor threw his money and influence behind Netanyahu. Adelson funds Israel Hayom, a free daily newspaper that supports the prime minister. Adelson also donated to President Donald Trump's campaign, helping connect Netanyahu and Trump. Since Trump took office, Lauder reportedly has tried to use his rapport with Trump, Netanyahu, and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas to restart peace talks, but the effort has gone nowhere. So now Lauder has twice taken to the op-ed pages of the New York Times to slam the man he once helped bring to power. Anybody who thinks the problems with Palestinians are all the fault of the Arabs needs to hear the latest news story from Israel. Last week, Palestinian postal workers struggled to sort through 10 tons of mail previously blocked by Israel, finally delivered as the result of a one-time deal. Some of these parcels date back to 2010 and include everything from letters to wheelchairs. Palestinian telecommunications minister Alam Musa blamed the backlog on Israel, which he accused of dragging its feet in implementing a postal service agreement with Ramallah. In response, the Israelis said an agreement would be implemented, but declined to go into details. One Palestinian official said he believed some of the packages were held up for both security and administrative reasons, and it would take weeks to sort through it all, at least. Israel's coordinator of government activities in the territory said the delivery of the packages followed the signing of an agreement about a year ago that had not yet been implemented. He characterized it as a confidence-building measure. In late 2016, the Israelis and Palestinians signed a memorandum of understanding to improve postal service between the two entities, with the Palestinian Authority handling international mail directly by way of the Allenby Bridge crossing between Israel and Jordan. Previously, Israel controlled all Palestinian mail, despite an agreement signed in 2008. And you thought the U.S. Postal Service was bad. Look, sooner or later, and since this is the Middle East, the bets are all on later, there will be two states, perhaps three, Israel and Palestine West Bank and maybe Palestine Gaza, and mail will just be mail. You simply cannot pretend that the 51-year-old semi-status quo that exists now in the West Bank is reasonable or a good thing.
I ask no favor for my sex. All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks.
And in a story you cannot make up, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the female Jewish supreme who has become an icon for many progressive people over the past few years, now has a new tribute, an action figure that retails for $20 and helps raise funds for schoolgirls hoping to be the first person in their family to graduate from high school. The so-called Notorious RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, recently celebrated her 25th anniversary on the High Court, and you can now play with her action figure, featuring her signature white collar, wire-rimmed glasses, and hardwood gavel. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Katka Reszke is a writer, filmmaker, photographer who works in the U.S. and in Poland. She's the author of Return to the Jew, Identity Narratives of the Third Post-Holocaust Generation of Jews in Poland. We're talking about that return to Judaism and the fascinating experience. And she is a research associate at the Dasa Brandeis Institute. We were talking earlier about this kind of the dynamic quality of this return. How many do we even really know how many Poles have Jewish blood, Jewish grandparents, great grandparents? Do they really know?
We really don't know. And I can't imagine that we will in the course of our lives or the course of the lives of our children. I don't think that we will ever know. Just this morning, I received another email from somebody who says there are too many mysteries in my family for me to not suspect that I'm Jewish. I've in the course of my work, I have become almost this kind of unlicensed counselor for a lot of people who approach me to ask me what they can do when they have a suspicion that they might be Jewish and they seriously don't know what to do with it. I do think that there's this tremendously specific Polish quality to that suspicion. I think that Poland is this strange land where these hunches, as I call them, that you might have Jewish roots or have just become really prominent. That is my personal story, so it's easy for me to talk to other people who have since sort of appearing in my life, coming to me, and I've had people send people to me to tell me that they too have a story like this. I also recently I was at a conference and I actually heard how DNA research in terms of Jewish genetics is now taking quite a turn, where a lot of the DNA testing results have been really put to quite many questions, in the sense that probably DNA research is not going to be an answer for a lot of people. Now, that being said, there are still only a few people that still have a chance to to interview their grandparents, if they're still alive.
Right, of course.
And then, of course, for a lot of people, that it's already too late with that. And for a lot of people, interviewing your grandparents is just won't do the job. There are still many grandparents out there who will still deny it. Many people have been quote unquote lucky to receive deathbed confessions. But otherwise, it's not very easy. The fear is so deeply ingrained in a lot of people still in Poland, and it has been for many generations. And for young people today to try to uncover the Jewish past of their families is just a very difficult task.
And it should be noted, you know, while, look, until I went to Poland just about 3 years ago, I had no desire to go to Poland. Two of my grandparents are from Poland, you know, Jewish immigrants, of course. Poland symbol, Auschwitz was the symbol of Poland. And then, but the truth is, it wasn't just the Shoah, it wasn't just the Holocaust and some long history of anti-Semitism. It was also the communist period in which being Jewish was no advantage anywhere in the Eastern Bloc. So there was a tremendous denial, almost forced in a societal way throughout society. I mean, governmentally, it was a policy, right?
Sure, and you know, I mean, it's just been so many decades in Poland during which it was just not a desirable identity to come out with if you could hide it. And so many people did, and they did so very successfully. And, you know, the irony, of course, is that the more successful our ancestors were in hiding their Jewishness, the less successful we will be in discovering that we actually have Jewish roots. And that has been a big challenge for my generation in Poland. And I'm really, at this point, a very old specimen of that generation. I'll be turning 40 this year, but there are 18-year-olds out there today who have reasons to believe that they might be Jewish and real difficulty being able to find proof.
You seem very young to me. I just have to add that.
Well, thank you.
So the 18-year-old, so an 18-year-old comes to you because you're now the expert, right? You wrote the book. You've been doing this now for 25 years.
Well, they're also coming to me because of the book that I'm writing now.
Mm-hmm.
And the book that I'm writing now, which is called The Meshuggah Effect, deals specifically with the hunch. I'm writing about several stories of mostly women, but it turns out not only women, who have a hunch that they have Jewish roots, and then they go on a journey of discovery. Some of them successful, and some of them less successful at it. And in the process of writing the book, I realized that I do not have the moral right to not write about the stories of the people that believe strongly that they're Jewish but can't actually prove it, mostly because it was my story years ago. It isn't anymore because I know that I was right about my hunch. But what about the people who don't know they're right about their hunches? I decided that it would just be really not right to not give them a voice as well in the book. So those stories are also included. And those are, I think, the very difficult stories. But they're also stories that I think are stories that are happening in the Jewish world. And it is we have an obligation to tell them and to hear them. These are stories that inform so much about how we think about who is a Jew and what it means to be a Jew today in the world.
It's fascinating to me to watch people trying to find their Judaism. And I would not be surprised if some of those people who had this hunch and it turned out not to be true ended up converting to Judaism somewhere down the road.
Yes, and some of them do, and some of them end up not necessarily going through a formal conversion, but find ways to become part of the Jewish community, you know, as volunteers or simply employees. I see it happening all the time. You've seen it happen in Krakow. It happens elsewhere. It's hard because the biggest challenge, I think, for those people is actually to find acceptance on part of the larger, Jewish collective. And it's not always easy.
When you began this process, this hunch, you might be Jewish, you had Jewish origins, and you started to explore, did you receive resistance from people?
I was lucky. I think I did not receive a whole lot of resistance, but I also personally resisted to present my story as such to people at the beginning. I had a very vague memory of my great-grandmother calling me Meshuggah when I was little, which is how I came up with the title for the book.
The title for the next book, yeah.
But But I also didn't want everybody to immediately think I was meshuggah. So I didn't tell everybody that I had a hunch I was Jewish. I based my, you know, my first steps into the Jewish community on just a few convoluted family stories that pointed to the possibility of me having some Jewish roots. And then I realized that there were other people my age, a little older and a little younger, who were having very similar issues, very similar stories. And, you know, some of them were luckier in that they knew for sure that grandpa was Jewish, but some of them were less lucky and they actually couldn't prove it. And it took me years to realize how the difference between us was really the difference in how we coped living in the world where other people judge you and think certain things of you, and how we sort of all needed to find our own personal models of being Jewish. And we needed to work this out for ourselves individually. And I think a lot of people do, and I think some people don't. And it's sad because, I do think that there are Jews that get lost in the world because they don't find a way to permeate the Jewish communities they want to permeate.
And you know, of course, that's not restricted to Poland. There's a common experience in the United States. It's a common experience nearly everywhere in the Jewish world. It feels to me in Poland like it's... And this isn't really the right word, but it's like a giant Jewish laboratory right now, in which people are exploring how they can be Jewish and what Jewish identity means. But
it's
not
interesting.
In some...
you should say that. I have written about how Poland is a laboratory of Jewish identity.
See, great minds whirl down the same drain.
I have actually used that expression.
Well,
and I do believe it's true, and this is why I also think that there are tremendous educational opportunities for North American Jews and for Israeli Jews to visit Poland and to experience some of those, you know, adventures and Jewish identities that are taking place there, because they are something else. And I do think that they have a transformative value for a lot of people who witness them.
There's a vitality to it, and an urgency to it, but also a lack of preordained norms in the way that people are approaching their Jewish identity. You know, you don't have to do these six things to be considered Jewish.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's one of the characteristics of Jews in Poland today, in all generations that we have in Poland, is that we resist models. And, you know, this could be a long history of oppression and just resistance.
Yeah.
Playing
there was the Cossacks and the Germans and the Hungarians, and everybody invaded Poland at some point or another. Russians, of course. Sure.
Yeah, but the truth is that models don't pre-existing, you know, ready-made models, they don't work in Poland, because you can't transplant American Jewish experience of today to today's Poland. You just can't. It just will not work. Rabbis have attempted it, and the good ones have realized soon enough that it's not going to work, and they work with what there is. And that is, I think, just a tremendously individualized community of people where nobody forces themselves, I think, anymore, and they're not so much forced to fit a certain model. And that's something that makes Jewish identity in Poland extremely dynamic and active and just really filled with more questions than answers. And I think that maybe that's the trick to not having to force kids to want to be Jewish. Because in Poland, it just works somehow.
It does, and I have to say, you know, the idea that you need to ask more questions seems so intensely Jewish in every possible way. Maybe maybe the questions are the answers. I want to thank Katka Reschke for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about your so interesting work?
People can go to www.katkareschke.com. That is just my name. That's my website. People are welcome to contact me on Facebook. I use Facebook as a work tool. If you think you might have Jewish roots, I will happily talk to you.
If you think you might be Jewish, or have some Jewish roots, this is the person to talk to. I see a big, big sidelight for you here.
It's almost scary. But I'm looking forward to it.
Katka, thank you so much, and I hope we cross paths soon, maybe back in Krakow.
Absolutely. Many thanks. All the best.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guests on Too Jewish will be Laura Adkins and Aidan Pink, editors of the Forward's 2018 Jewish Guide to College. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from 613. It's called Starting Over for Rosh Hashanah, coming up just 3 weeks from now. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
It's Rosh Hashanah. All the time keeps ticking on. Just another year of moments come and gone. We're that much older, but are we wiser? Have our hearts grown that much colder? Have we ceased to do our part? 'Cause I'm starting over. I'm looking back. 'Cause I've done things that I'm not proud of. In this year we're coming out of. Now's the time for introspection. Time to forge a new direction. Decide who I wanna be. A brand new year, a brand new me. 'Cause I'm starting over. Blow the shofar. Sound the call for us to change. A brand new year, a brand new me. I'm starting over. I'm moving past. I'm putting all my sins behind me. The errors of old ways won't find me. Let's put our whole selves in this. Let's return and seek forgiveness. Be what it means to be a Jew.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.